KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Francisco in the Glen Park area.
Sunset, Portola Valley.
Coming up, we continue our multiple award-winning week-long series on lead poisoning in Alameda County. Today, we meet families who feel stuck choosing between housing that's affordable and housing that's safe.
I know my neighbors, they're afraid because the rent is still kind of low, so they don't want to move out, even though they know there's all these problems.
And what happens when a home is poisoning a family, but they can't afford to live anywhere else?
So I put them in a homeless shelter because their chance of getting safe housing jumps up.
Stay put and take the risk, or stand up to the landlord and maybe get kicked out.
He pretty much evicted us. He evicted us, actually, because he couldn't fix it.
Lead and the Bay Area housing crisis. Today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Neighborhoods in Alameda County have higher rates of lead poisoning than Flint, Michigan. But in Flint, the main source of lead is the water, and here, it's the homes. The U.S. banned lead paint 40 years ago, but that paint still coats the walls, doors, and window frames of many Bay Area houses. And the children who live there can ingest toxic paint chips and dust. Lead poisoning can cause brain damage, developmental delays, learning disabilities, and even violent behavior. Yesterday on the show, we met public health nurse Diep Tran, our guide into Alameda County's lead crisis.
Because if you give up too soon, the child doesn't recover. If the child doesn't recover, he surely will end up with behavioral and learning problems. And then the parent will say, "See? That lead nurse doesn't care."
We also spent time with the family she's working with, the Rasos. They're struggling to admit that the source of their son Antonio's lead poisoning is, in fact, the place they feel the most safe, their home.
And say nothing.
Today, the second story in our award-winning series, which originally aired in the spring. This episode is all about housing. KALW's Angela Johnston and Marissa Ortega-Welch explore how Alameda's lead problem goes hand in hand with the region's high rents. Here's Angela.
After we met little Antonio and his parents and saw how much housing and lead poisoning can go hand in hand, we asked Alameda County public health nurse Diep Tran to help us find another family whose living situation was complicated by lead poisoning. She deals with 150 different lead poisoned children at any one time and called us constantly, leaving us voicemails about families interested in sharing their stories.
I tried calling you three times and the line went through, but there was no answer.
Eventually, Diep connects us with the Sharifs, and we meet them in San Leandro, where they used to live.
Hi.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Good to meet you.
Sulika and Tarek Sharif still own a hummus factory there.
What's her name?
She's with her dad, Coco.
Can you say hello into the microphone?
Say hello.
Hello.
What's your name?
Coco. Coco.
Their three-year-old daughter, Cowcub, loves playing outdoors. When we visit, she runs between empty food crates, deep in a game of hide-and-go-seek with her mom.
Go! Your shoes, my God!
This is my husband. We're gonna go together in the office. We could talk about it.
Hey, I told you that hurts. Let me hold you.
Inside the factory, they make dozens of different types of hummus. And chips, too. Piles of ripped pita bread sizzle in the deep fryer and then get packaged and shipped off to farmers markets around the Bay Area. The hummus factory is right down the street from the studio apartment this family used to live in. That's where their story began, a little over 3 years ago. Tarek had just opened the business. He worked late nights, sleeping on the couch to not disturb his wife and daughter when he came home.
One day I got sick. For 3 days I was sick in the house. I couldn't even move.
He had a really bad lingering cold that he just couldn't shake. Sulika and Cowcub got it too.
She was sick for about 4 months, 6 months, and she was getting what we might call a cold and sneezing.
It only seemed to go away when they left the house, like when they went on vacation. Then one day, Tarek realized he couldn't find his wedding ring. They tore apart the house looking for it, pulling out the dresser, peering down the sink.
And we flipped the couch over and everything was green and black.
Mold. everywhere.
I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was in a shock.
He says rainwater that collected on the roof seeped into their walls and onto the floor. The mold was disgusting, unhealthy, but they were about to discover something worse.
I took my daughter to the hospital just to check her out to see if she had anything, mold or anything.
The doctors ran other tests too.
And that's when we realized that she had lead. The only thing I could think of, it came from the apartment.
The Centers for Disease Control say there's no safe level for lead, but the threshold for intervention is when the blood shows more than 5 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood. Kaukeb's blood registered a lead level of 23, which means it was really high.
She stopped eating first. She was always crying for no reason. Under her eye was dark circle. She wanted only my breast milk and not other food. And she will sleep a lot.
That unusual behavior terrified Sulika and Tarek.
I blame myself. I said it's my fault. I thought I didn't take care of her and she ate something that did not pay attention to it.
The doctor immediately faxed Kaukeb's high results to the county, and the response network kicked into gear. Dieppe, the public health nurse, called the Sheriffs, and the Alameda County Healthy Homes Department came by to inspect the property for lead.
But by the time the county inspectors got there, the Sheriffs say their landlord had painted over the mold and the lead, so they couldn't find any initial evidence. Painting over lead does contain it, temporarily solving the problem and making it undetectable. But here's what both the Sheriffs and the county think happened. The mold wore down the paint on the walls, paint that had lead in it.
And the painting was deteriorating.
Those lead particles made their way into the air and on the floor where Kaukeb played.
And she would get affected more than us. We could breathe it, but because we are adults, we could get rid of it faster than she does.
Once they got Kaukeb into the county's lead reduction program, the Sheriffs moved out temporarily, staying with family while the landlord said he finished up the repairs. But as soon as they moved back in, Tarek says,
the same problem started again.
Kaukeb's lead levels didn't go down like they should. The whole family started to get sick again. Tarek says he could tell the mold and the lead weren't really gone.
So he says he called the landlord.
I took him inside the house and I showed him, you know, the same problem again.
And the landlord's solution?
He wanted to move me to another apartment.
A neighboring unit in the building. Tarek wanted the county to come and inspect that unit, too.
And I told him, before I could move to another apartment, I'm going to bring in a whole team and test the place. And then I'll move in. If it's safe, I'll move in. And I think that's what actually triggered everything. He evicted us right after that.
Tarek claims their landlord evicted his family because they started to put up a fight.
The Sheriffs have sued their former landlord for wrongful eviction and a host of other habitability claims. Basically, they allege their apartment wasn't safe to live in.
The same day he kicked us out, he had another family move in, into the apartment itself. He didn't even clean it. He didn't do a thing. Nothing. I mean, we moved out midnight, and a new family came in at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they were already in the apartment.
We spoke with the lawyer for the Sheriff's landlord and the property management company. He said he can't comment because the case is ongoing, but that his clients categorically deny any and all of the Sheriff's claims and have not seen any evidence with merit. Tarek Sheriff says he's worried someone else will get sick, staying in his old apartment building.
I know my neighbors, they're afraid because the rent is still kind of low, and so they don't want to move out, even though they know there's all these problems.
The Sheriffs paid about $900 a month for their old place. The fair market rent for a studio in Alameda County is just over $1,500. Many go for more. When they searched for a new place in San Leandro near Tarek's hummus shop, they couldn't find anything. Eventually, they moved to Milpitas, a 40-minute drive away, into a house they share with Tarek's brother's family. 7 people live together.
The children, they have their rooms. We have our rooms. We have garden. They could go play. Place looks very safe.
Their rent nearly quadrupled, but it's safe. Tarek says he had the house tested as soon as he moved in. And more importantly, he says, Kaukeb's acting like herself again.
Now she's developing normal. She's grown normal. I mean, she speaks, 7 or 8 languages? She counts. She knows numbers. She knows, yeah.
How old are you? تقول ثلاثة.
ثلاثة.
Hey, Arabic, three.
Say three, Mama.
No.
No.
No. Her lead levels have gone down significantly too.
She's fine. She's eating well. She's playing. She's 100% healthy. And I'm happy.
For a family dealing with a lead poisoned child, the Sharifs were actually lucky. They had a safety net, some savings, and family they could move in with.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba, and we're listening to the second story in our week-long series about lead poisoning in the Bay Area from KALW reporters Marissa Ortega-Welch and Angela Johnston. The series first aired in March, and last month it won multiple awards from the Society of Professional Journalists of Northern California. We just met a family who believes their daughter got lead poisoning from their apartment building. They complained to their landlord, and the family claims he evicted them because of it. They were able to move in with family nearby, but not everyone has that option. So let's get back to the story. Here's KALW's Angela Johnston.
What happens to the families that can't take a risk, that can't complain about their living situation? Remember Diep Tran, the woman who handles severe lead poisoning cases in Alameda County? She's a nurse, but she also acts as a housing advocate. She says she always asks families about their income. And then, if they can't afford to find another place to live, she says,
okay, would you be willing to go to a homeless shelter? Yes. So I put them in a homeless shelter because once they're in the shelter, their chance of getting hopefully affordable and less safe housing jumps up.
I ask, does Diep really suggest that families go to homeless shelters?
Yes, if they cannot afford to move. Some of them are pretty resourceful. They go to Stockton.
Or Vallejo, Concord, or Antioch. Suburbs on the edge of the Bay Area with cheaper, newer homes that don't have lead paint.
They move in with a relative. And as soon as they move out of that place, the child's blood lead level drops.
Diep says with many of her cases, she strongly urges families to move if the lead problem is too difficult to fix or if the property owners can't be persuaded. State laws dictate landlords must maintain the property, including addressing lead hazards, if there is a lead-poisoned child. But Diep says landlords can claim that they want to sell the property instead.
If they want to sell the property, we cannot force them to do the lead hazard work so that the family can continue to live there. And what if they really not trying to sell the property, they just want the family to move so they don't have to do the work? I cannot go back in 3 months and snoop around and see if that's what the property owners meant when they said that they are selling. Sometimes they evict the family and they change their mind. They say, oh, we're not going to sell. We're going to hold on to this.
And then they can rent to someone who can pay more or sell the property altogether. She says sometimes this type of gentrification leads to lead cleanup.
After a low-income family moves out, the property owners repaint and remodel the apartment or the house and charge double or triple the price.
The lead is gone, but that only benefits wealthier people. The Sharifs were lucky to have family in the Bay Area, but Diep says for most people,
they are forced to move away from their relatives and friends, their support system. But at the same time, the housing stock in Stockton and Vallejo and Concord may have fewer lead hazards.
In Alameda County, there are over 400,000 homes built before lead paint was banned in 1978. Hundreds of thousands of chances a child could get lead poisoning. As Sulika Sharif points out, that older housing stock often ends up going to people who have fewer resources to deal with problems like lead. She says she thinks sometimes landlords even rent to immigrants or refugees for this reason.
To follow up on our hunch, we called a handful of Bay Area housing agencies. They told us they're seeing an alarming trend in the Bay Area, clusters of refugees and immigrants in unsafe housing. And it has a name, predatory habitability. Landlords taking advantage of people they know won't be able to fight back. Here's Sulika.
You know, most of the time I don't hear like American kids got lead.
The Sharifs came to the U.S. from Africa. Sulika from Djibouti. Tarek from Tunisia.
The problem is when parents come as immigrant here, they are not going to stay in good house, nice house and so on. They will just put them in house for immigrants. And those houses usually are not safe.
Lead paint from old houses causes the majority of lead poisoning cases in Alameda County, 70%. But the county says different ethnic groups bring in their own products that contain lead, some turmeric from India or eye makeup from Afghanistan. These lead-based products can make kids really sick, too. As the number of immigrants to the county increases, so does the number of different ways kids can get lead poisoned.
Sulika and Tarek said before the county inspectors came to look at the house, the questions from Dieppe came at them like gunfire, one after the other. What products did you bring back with you from Africa? Did any of them have lead in them?
How do you put her to sleep? What do you give it to her as food? What does, how do you take care of her?
They came, they searched the whole house. Yeah. And then I was willing for them to do that. I mean, I wanted to find out. I mean, I care for my daughter. And it takes time for you to realize that this had nothing to do with us. I mean, they have to point the finger at somebody. To be real honest, I'm really disgusted with the system.
They felt Dieppe and her team automatically assumed that because they were immigrants, African immigrants in particular, they caused Kaukeb's high lead levels.
Yes, and the funny thing, instead of saying this is the place that where you were living, they talk asking you maybe using cultural, traditional things, makeups, like there is something they call kohl.
Kohl is a type of eye makeup used in Middle Eastern countries. Parents will put it on and around their child's eyelids to ward off bad spirits. Some brands have extremely high concentrations of lead, but Sulika says they didn't use kohol on Kaukeb. It's actually not part of her tradition.
They assume because I came from East Africa and because we are Muslim and Muslims use this as a tradition.
She said at first she felt that Dieppe and her colleagues at the Lead Poisoning Prevention Program blamed them and their culture. She was worried she'd get in trouble for something she didn't do.
She told me that if you were not educated or if you did not go to school and so on, I will be watching you and calling you all the time.
Who told you that?
Dieppe, the public health nurse, who calls herself Mariposa for Spanish-speaking clients, who wears a headscarf on visits to Muslim families, who's learned the word for lead in her clients' languages.
But Sulika still saw Dieppe as a government employee who could accuse Sulika of being a bad mom.
We asked Dieppe about this, how she navigates families' cultures and traditions while also addressing their safety. She sticks to a questionnaire written in 2004 by the California Department of Public Health State Lead Program. She says it hasn't been updated since. She starts flipping through hers and shows us.
All the questions are there. Like, was the child born here? And if they say no, then where? You don't assume anything.
Dieppe says if Sulika and Tarek were offended by her questions, it's because she was following that script.
They may be from Afghanistan, but the child may be born in New Jersey or whatever. And then you go down the list, you ask them things like, have you ever lived in a house with peeling paint, use eye makeup, depending on the culture. If I interview a Mexican family or an American family, I would not ask that.
She says she sees some families shut down.
I watch their body language, and if I can tell if they're offended, I will ask them, do you have any questions? You have to let them know that they are in charge and you are a guest. So if they want to end the visit, that's okay.
At the end of the day, Dieppe works for a government program that has rules. Dieppe says she has to do her job so she can move on to the next family as soon as she can.
So I will explain to them that, you know, the things that I tell you, you may not agree with them, but it's my job. And I work for the county. I have to do what the county in the state lead program asked me to do. But you must remember that you don't live in Afghanistan or Pakistan or China anymore. You live in the U.S. now.
We circle back to the Sharifs. Despite their challenges with Dieppe, they've still worked with her for 3 years. Do they still feel like she's blaming them?
No.
No, I mean
the beginning.
It's not really, I mean, because I know Dieppe. I mean, she's doing her job. This is what she does. She gets concerned, she wants to help. But then the way the system educated her and how to approach families, it comes in kind of harsh. I mean, you might know a couple of things that we don't know, but at the end of the day, she's my daughter. I mean, I'm going to care for her more than anybody else.
In San Leandro, I'm Angela Johnston.
And I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch for Cross Currents.
You've been listening to the second story in a week-long series, Persistent Poison, on lead poisoning. The series originally aired in March. Since then, our reporters followed up with the Sharifs. The family settled with their landlord out of court and were awarded money for damages. They're renting their own place now in Berkeley, a house they love. And Kokab Sharif is doing okay. Her blood lead level is down, but not completely gone. In the next piece in our series, we'll learn that getting a clear picture of the lead landscape is harder than it looks.
How well are we doing at finding the kids with elevated blood lead levels? What we're finding is that we're not doing a terribly good job at it.
The lead data gap, tomorrow evening on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. This week, we've been re-airing our award-winning series on lead poisoning in the Bay Area. In the piece we just heard, a family said they were afraid to complain to their landlord about unsafe living conditions because they worried they'd get evicted. When they complained, they say their landlord kicked them out. Housing advocates see this and similar situations a lot. They call it predatory habitability. Associate Fair Housing Director Jacqueline Ramirez works at a Bay Area Fair Housing agency called Project Sentinel, and she joins us in studio. So, Jacqueline, what exactly is predatory habitability?
Predatory habitability is the notion that a housing provider targets a specific group of people with the idea in mind that that group of people is less likely to know their rights or exercise their rights, mm-hmm. and therefore they can get away with more and not fulfilling their obligations to provide a safe and healthy environment.
So they're relying on the fear of those people.
Exactly.
So in the story we just heard, a family complained to their landlord about lead hazards in their apartment, but said many other families were afraid, to talk because they feared eviction. Many of them were immigrants. And I'm wondering, have you seen any of this in your work?
Unfortunately, it's a very common story, particularly in our market because it's so expensive. And we don't just see it with lead. That's quite an extreme example. But we see it with all kinds of conditions like pest infestations, mold, repair issues, just generally unmaintained properties, unsafe living conditions. And it is with a lot of newer immigrants more than anything, usually monolingual speakers, non-English monolingual speakers.
And is that fear founded? Like, do landlords really evict?
Absolutely.
So how do you prove these cases? How do you prove there was discrimination?
It's difficult, but it is possible. So either we can compare. So if a landlord happens to have a building or a section of a building that is primarily non-immigrant or English-speaking, in most cases Caucasian, and that section of the building or that particular building is in a better area of the community or is just better maintained, or if those tenants don't have the same experience having difficulty getting repairs or having pest infestations and things like that. Mm-hmm. But we also look to see how the apartments are being advertised. If it's a landlord that we know speaks both Spanish and English or whatever foreign language and English, we start wondering or seeing, do they only advertise in the foreign language? A lot of people rely on word of mouth of their tenants, and that's another way that they ensure that they only have that type of tenant living there. Also, we're able to do what we call audits, which are kind of like secret shopper situations, and test a property. Mm-hmm. I just use quotes, but I know you can't see that. We're able to test a property and send people. And normally what we want to see is, oh, they won't rent to the Black person or Latino person or Muslim person or whatever the protected class is. In this case, though, what we're trying to prove is that they will only rent to the person of the protected uh-huh. class, and they won't rent even to somebody like me who's Latina, but I speak fluent English. I'm more likely to know my rights or whatever the assumptions are, whether true or not. This is how the housing provider thinks.
That is so interesting. What do you think this has to do with the housing crisis? What relationship do you see there?
Oh, so much. So when you're forced to live wherever you can afford, you're also forced to live in whatever conditions mm-hmm. that gets you. The saying you buy or you pay what you get for, something like that. It's very true in housing. Mm-hmm. And
you get what you pay for.
Yes, you get what you pay for. Thank you. And that's just as true in housing. So even if you know that you're being targeted and that these things are happening or repairs aren't happening because of your ethnicity or your race, you're less likely to speak up because you don't want to be the squeaky wheel and you don't want to draw that attention to yourself, especially if you know that your neighbors aren't going to come up and stick out their neck along with you.
That was Project Sentinel's Associate Fair Housing Director, Jacqueline Ramirez. You can hear a full-length version of that interview online at kalw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.